Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. The South is responsible for the three greatest beverages in human history: sweet tea, Coca-Cola, and most of all, bourbon. And nobody alive has been involved with more bourbon than a man named Jimmy Russell. Jimmy has worked at the Wild Turkey Distillery in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky for 64 years. He holds the official title of Master Distiller and the unofficial title of the Buddha of Bourbon.
You know, everybody can taste, but you got to know what you're looking for.
A rival distiller told me one time that Jimmy Russell can tell more about bourbon with one nostril than most people can with their whole bodies. I reached Jimmy at his office in Kentucky. His workday had started early. So, Jimmy Russell, we are doing this interview at about 10 o'clock in the morning. Have you had a taste of bourbon yet this morning?
Oh, yes. You have to start early in the morning. We have to taste the new product. What we made just early, we always taste it to make sure it meets our standards before we put it in a new charred oak barrel. We want a good product going in the barrel. If you put a bad product in the barrel, it's not going to be good, say, 8 to 10 years from now. So it has to be good the day it goes in the barrel.
So what time did you start?
I started about 8 o'clock this morning.
Uh-huh. That sounds like, I have to say, that sounds like a pretty good job.
Somebody's got to do the dirty work.
What's the first memory that you have of bourbon? Either smelling it or tasting it or being around it? What do you remember from as far back as you can remember?
Well, the first I can't remember, raised in a bourbon family, you know, when you start cutting teeth, they would take a little bourbon and rub on your gums when you're cutting teeth. But I guess the first, not remembering, but sometime, you know, in the wintertime when you got a cold or anything like that, they'd take a little bourbon, a little honey, and a little lemon, a little give it to you for a cough and all. You begin to realize at that time what you was tasting.
And do you remember it from back then?
Not hardly, but, you know, didn't start drinking until I was 21. Now, you believe that?
I'm not sure I believe that, Mr. Russell. Go ahead.
Raised around a bourbon family and in bourbon country, you know.
now when you say you was raised around a bourbon family, what does that mean?
Well, my grandfather worked at a bourbon distillery here in Lawrenceburg. My dad worked at a bourbon distillery here in Lawrenceburg. And then I've been here, if I make it September the 10th this year, it'll be 65 years here.
Wow.
64. I'm sorry, 64.
Well, then, you know, once you get that high, it's hard to keep track, right?
Well, I've been married 65 years to my wife.
So now tell me how you ended up getting into the bourbon business.
Well, actually, you know, say my family here in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky at that time, there was a lot of distilleries here, and all of my family, my dad worked at a distillery, my uncles and all worked, some of my aunts worked at distilleries, and it was just natural. At my age, you want to stay at home and get a job. And actually, my wife, Joretta, was working here at the Wild Turkey Distillery before I was. So I come to work with her, and we worked together for about 7 or 8 years. And then our children come along. She stayed home, took care of the children, and I continued to work on. And then after the children went to school, she went back to high school administration then, and she's retired from the Anderson County High School here now.
Uh-huh. And what kind of jobs were y'all doing when you first started out at the distillery?
Well, she was in office administration then, and I started out in quality control and distillery, working in quality control and distillery.
Now, what does quality control mean? Like, what kind of stuff would you be doing?
Well, different nowadays. Then you would sample. We're very heavy on quality control here. We'd have to check the grain trucks, run analysis on the grain. We'd run analysis on the product every day, tasting. And then back in that day and time, you might end up unloading it too, shoveling it out of the trucks and everything. You done a little bit of everything. And I was fortunate enough, the old master distiller here, he more or less took me under his wing And he'd been a distiller before Prohibition, and he come back and put this distillery in operation after Prohibition. And basically, he just took me under his wing, started training me in everything in our business. Chemistry, science, and engineering helps you in this business, but it's so many things that it's hands-on. You learn by doing it. It's so many things I can't prove to you scientifically or anything. It's a lot of things will happen that you can't prove it.
I was wondering if I figured that when you first got there in the 50s, there were probably a lot of people working there who had run stills during Prohibition, right?
Probably.
As far as just theoretically, let's say. Now, yes. were there things that they knew that ended up becoming useful in the sort of, for lack of a better word, legitimate business?
Oh, yes. Yes, you know, that's where really, I guess, first distillations was the moonshiners and all. Well, actually, the first distillation was perfume, distilling perfume. I understand if you look back over the history of first distillation, was probably perfume, distilling, making perfumes.
And so do you remember what some of those guys taught you when you were first starting out about, you know, how the what you should be looking for and tasting for and that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. You know, the main thing, you have to have good water. That's the reason most all the bourbon distilleries are right here in the central part of Kentucky. It's all limestone area. You got to have good water. You got to have good grain. And then you have to, you know, you each formula. I use simple terms. We come under federal government supervision. The federal government restrict how bourbon has to be made. It has to be made from at least 51% corn. It has to be distilled under 160 proof. Must be put in a new charred oak barrel at 125 proof or less. No flavor or no color or nothing could be added to it. When you're charring white oak, it caramelizes the sugar and the vanillas and all. Then when you store it and aging it, the bourbon in the summertime, it's got to get hot and expand out into that wood. The wintertime, it's got to extract. It's got to move in and out. It's got to breathe. And that's where you have to pick up all your color and your flavors and all.
That's something I saw when I did a couple of those bourbon tours back a few years ago. You know, there's so many other businesses where there's so much technology involved and like robots can do it and that sort of thing. And the bourbon business, I know there is more technology now, but the essence of it is still this old stuff that's kind of the same way people have been doing it for a couple hundred years, right?
Right, right. It's the same thing. You know, our formula hasn't changed. We're still using the same formulas that did when I come here in 1954. And we make our own yeast. We have our own yeast culture. And all I can tell you, I know the yeast is at least 64 years old. It was here when I got here, and we're still using the same yeast culture. Now, a lot of people's went to different sack yeast now, but we still make our own yeast every day.
And so, and you take some of that out and make it a starter for the next batch? Is that how it works?
Yes, we make yeast every day, and we keep the same strain of yeast going all the time.
Now, when you started in 1954, what was the like life at the factory or the distillery? How did that look different than it does now?
Well, of course, everything running, you just got better equipment. Now, everything was done by hand. You had to set it to still with a hand on a steam valve and a hand on a pump controlling the product going through the still to make sure it's consistent all day long and everything. Now, we have computers now. But now, like you said, they make computers now that you could run this place from anywhere. But our computers, instead of doing it by hand, we still have operators, and they push buttons. Instead of having to do it by hand, they can just push a button and change temperatures and pump speeds and things like that. We still have to have operators on our distill and everything. But the computers is, you know, if you're running it by hand, sometimes you might be a little slow changing something. Computers is more accurate and faster changing if something goes wrong.
Yeah. Now, I remember reading or hearing that you fellas working at the distillery used to play pranks on each other in the old days. Now, what was some of the stuff y'all would do to each other?
Well, now, some of us talking here a while back. If you'd done that now, you'd be breaking up a fight every minute. But if you went to the distillery, down the distillery, around the distillery in the summertime, you'd get bucket of water poured on your head, and you never know who it come from or anything. In the wintertime, I had hair then. I don't have hair now. But they dump meal on top of your head. You never know who done it. You just got even with somebody the next time.
See, you know, but you get somebody else, and you figure it all even out.
Right.
So, how did you develop or discover that you had the taste buds to make yourself a distiller?
Well, this is something, you know, everybody can taste, but you've got to know what you're looking for. The day we're tasting a new product, we're basically looking for the grainy, yeasty, sweetness taste. And then as it's sitting here aging each year, we're tasting it, and we know where it's got to be at 2-year-old or 4-year-old or 6-year-old to get 7 to 12-year-old. You're looking for the caramel, the vanilla, the sweetness, the nutty, the fruity is basically what we're looking. To me, the two of the most important things in tasting is the aroma. That's very important to me. And the last thing I look for is the finish. What kind of taste does it leave in your mouth? And I use simple terms explaining to people. You walk in the restaurant, what's the first impression you get of the food? Is the aroma that's coming off of it. If it doesn't smell good, I don't care how good it tastes, you done decided it's not any good. Same way, if you eat food and it don't leave a good taste in your mouth, you don't want it anymore. So you want a good taste, a good aroma, that caramel, vanilla, sweetness. And then you want it to leave a good finish in your mouth.
Now, how do you do that? I've seen on TV and stuff these wine guys, you know, they take a big sniff of the bottle. I mean, a big sniff of the glass. They slosh it around their mouth for a while. And then how do you go about approaching it when you get a glass and you're trying to evaluate it?
Well, the first thing I do is look at the color, because in bourbon is the only product in the world you can't add color to. It has to be a natural color. I'm looking for a color, and you know what color it should be at 2 or 4 or 6 down. And then the next thing is the aroma, the smell, looking for that good caramel, vanilla, sweetness smell.
And now, how do you do that? Do you just stick your nose down in there, or do you use one nostril or both nostrils? How do you do that?
We got tasting glasses there. It's bigger at the bottom and real narrow at the top where you can get. And I like to smell with my mouth open and smell again with my mouth closed. You'd be surprised. Now, when we're training tasters, we have 5 official tasters here, and 3 of the 5 must prove every batch before we put it in a barrel. Also, when we're aging and when we get ready for bottling, we have to prove it. And you're looking for that. Now, when we start out new tasters, we got a lot of people in training because, you know, I've been here 64 years. My son's been here 37 years. So most everybody, the tasting panel, has been here for a long time. We have a lot of people in training. The first thing we do, we have different flavors, different aromas in powdered form and let you go through and start smelling and you write down what you smell. You find out real quick whether they're going to be a taster or not. If they write down something that's aroma they're getting out of a thing that we know is not in there, then you know they'll never be a taster. So everybody can tell you whether it's good or bad, but you got to know each step along the way. Our storage buildings are 7 stories tall, barrels rolled in on ricks. And you know, this time of year, it can be 30 degrees difference between the top floor and the bottom floors. So it ages faster in the top, so at times you have to take the top floors and move them to the bottom. It ages a lot slower in the bottom floor, so sometimes you have to move them up there. And when you're tasting, that's what you're looking for. Well, the center cut, we call it the 3rd, 4th, and 5th floors, are ideal. And the temperature and humidity is not that drastic a change.
And you smell it. You can tell right away if it's going to be something you like.
Right. That's just like here. You know, we come into the distillery right now. It's different aromas. Where it's making, you get that yeasty, grainy, new taste. Like I tell you, if it smells like good cooking fresh bread, you know,
right,
you're making a good product. The funniest thing about this is hard to believe, but I know from fact, I never smell anything. She's sitting here with me recording this. She probably got different aromas when she, I don't smell anything. She's shaking her head, yes. I don't smell anything. But if it's something wrong before I get out of my automobile, I know it's something wrong. But as long as it's normal, natural smell, you don't pay any attention to it. But visitors, we have a lot of visitors, and that's all they talk about, the aromas coming out of the making process, the fermentation, distillation, and then in the warehouse, the aging process. But actually, to me, I don't smell anything. You know, I know the normal smell, the more normal aromas, and as long as it's normal, you really don't. But if something's wrong, you know right then you need to start checking on things.
So if you get out of the car, you could tell right away if something's not right.
Yes,
by the smell.
By the aroma you're getting.
Uh-huh. And then, do you know how to fix that then?
Oh, yeah.
Or is that, that's what I didn't know, is if something smells bad or it smells off, is there still something you can do about it, or is that something you have to kind of throw out and start over?
No, most time you have to, if we're heavy quality here. We check our grains. We don't use any GMO grains and things like that. Our corn is basically the same type of corn that you'd buy at the grocery store for cornmeal. And we grind it, smell it before we're everything. We're checking everything. So, if we get something made, we'll hit it before the people's grinding the grain. Or when they're checking the grain, they know if the moisture's too high or it's got an off odor, they'll reject a load of grain. Or doing the cooking process, like at home, if you're cooking, all the time you're cooking, you're smelling that aroma and all. If you know this needs a little more salt, or this means a little more something else, you're going to do it right then. And that's the way with us. We know how to handle that when we, if something goes wrong. But normally nothing goes wrong time with all of our checking points. Time we get it made and ready to go in. And we also inspect the barrels. We use a No. 4 char barrel. And we inspect them to make sure they meet our char and everything. So if we get it in a barrel, it's several of us made a lot of bad mistakes.
And once it's in the barrel, how often do you check it as it's progressing?
Well, we know after the first, it doesn't change a whole lot the first 2 years. But after it's 2 years old, we're checking it every other year. We're tasting it every other year.
And then it's usually ready, and I know this depends on what the brand is and what you're trying to do, but a normal bourbon would be ready, 7-8 years, something like that?
I feel 7 to 12 is ideal. Most of your bourbons on the market is 4 and 5 years old. I just don't think they've aged long enough. I still get that newy, woody, grainy taste. And it's 7 to 12 now. And I don't like a real old bourbon. Now, we do limited editions every once in a while. We've got out of Master's Keep, Eddie, our son, has just put out his 3 in that series. One of them was 17 years old. One of them, one at one time deal, and there was this one of them was decade, had 10 to 20 year old bourbons in it, and now he's come out with Revival. It's been finished in sherry cask. That's his 3 as the new master distiller. And tasting, we're looking for things like that. I say, when we're doing limited edition 100 to 150 barrels, we can control that quite easy. But we're tasting it all the time. We've had a 14, a 15, a 17, and we're tasting. We find a few barrels we think's aging a little extra special, and we'll set them aside, maybe 100 to 150 barrels, and we're tasting them. And when we agree that it's reached its peak at 14 or 15 or 17, that's when we'll bottle it. We know by now we control 100 to 150 barrels because we can move them down in a little lower part of the warehouse and slow that aging down. We can't move 700,000 barrels, so we got 700,000 barrels in inventory right now.
When we come back, Jimmy Russell talks about doing commercials with Matthew McConaughey and the time that they delivered Thanksgiving turkeys together. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'm Mike Collins. Join me and Sarah D'Elia, host of the She Says podcast, for a special public conversation beyond She Says, sexual assault in Charlotte, Thursday evening, August 2nd at 7 p.m. at McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square. Registration at WFAE.org.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. My favorite comment this week comes from Shannon, who goes by Leap Year Cutie on Twitter. She tweeted this: "Listening to Southbound with Thierry Jones, when you said we need to keep writing, even if Oprah never calls. I got chills and my senses perked up. It was like my body was waiting to hear that. Time to resurrect my love of putting words on paper. Shannon, we really appreciate the kind words. If you enjoy Southbound, we want to hear from you. Leave a message on social media, or even better, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to all of you for listening. Now, back to our conversation with Jimmy Russell. Now, I saw on the news in the last couple weeks, you know, when I went to the Bourbon Tour, I remember seeing those big old rick houses.
Right.
And just thought those things looked sort of fragile to me. And I know, I guess it was Barton's, a couple weeks ago, the whole rick house collapsed and they lost pretty much everything, right? Do you ever worry about that sort of thing with what y'all are doing?
Oh, yeah. You know, the worst thing we worry about is fire. If one of those gets on fire, there's no putting it out. but again, we have a lot of tornadoes that come through here, too. But most of the time, you know, the way a storage building is built, you build a home, you build the walls outside, built outside, and then build the rooms inside. Mm-hmm. When they're building one of these storage buildings, they actually build the inside of it. Ours are metal clad, and then put the shell around the outside of it. And those barrels weigh 520 pounds apiece when they're new. So you got 20, it's a lot of weight in there. And most of the time, the tornadoes, we've had to tear roofs off, tear sides off, and the barrels are just sitting out and open in.
Are any of the folks that you worked with when you first started out, or the folks you got to know in your early years in the business, are any of those folks still around?
No, I lost my last good buddy. One, this is something else I enjoy. In the bourbon business here in Kentucky, we're all close friends. If one gets in trouble, others do anything they can to help them. It's just like you say 1792, that's part of Buffalo Trace. You know, we all, anything we can do for them, we will help them. Heaven Hill had a huge fire in 94, and everybody pitched in and helped them. You know, keep them going, and this is something I enjoy so much about it. We're all close friends, and we do. And my buddies back in that day, I'm the only one left of that, was Booker Knoll, Jim Beam, Elmer Lee, at Ancient, well, y'all call it Buffalo Trace, it's still Ancient Age to me. And then we lost Parker Beam at Heaven Hill last year, so that old bunch, I'm the only one left of them. My son, Eddie's 37 years now. And Fred Knoll, Booker's son, they're close friends. Then we all grew up, you know, together growing up, and our children grew up together. So we're together all the time.
Now, did you, as your, as your son came into the business, was that something you were really hoping would happen and you sort of nudged him that way? Or did he just sort of come into it on his own?
No, this is one thing I never believe in. Don't push your children into anything. If they don't want to come into it, why then? I have a daughter, older daughter, and older son, and neither one of them. But Eddie was playing football for Western Kentucky University. He tells the story. Mama told him me to put him to work one summer. He says it's been a long 37 summers. He said after the first, he enjoyed it, so he's been here ever since. And, you know, he's enjoying it. It's 37 years now. His son has been with us 5 years now. He's an ambassador for us now in Austin, Texas. And he spent 4 months here learning part of the trade before, and then he's been out promoting wild turkey. And now he's supposed to come back in September and start back training here again, so he'll be back here at the distillery.
So your grandfather, your father, you, your son, and his son. See, that's five, at least five generations in the bourbon business.
Right. It's three generations of the Russell family here right now. Me, my son, and his son, and then my granddaughter, my daughter's daughter's here.
Now, I know, you know, obviously these days, these distilleries are sort of tourist attractions and they have gift shops and all that stuff. I know back in the, I guess, the 70s or 80s, bourbon was having sort of a hard time, right?
Yeah, well, you know, the 50s, 60s, up into early 70s, bourbon was, but back in that day and time, bourbon was strictly a Southern gentleman's drink. They got their cards, their cigars, and their bourbon, and went to the back room and played cards. You know, the old story was, when I started, you never drank bourbon till after 5 o'clock. You know somewhere it's always 5 o'clock. But that was now it's become a worldwide drink. All over the world, we have a huge export market now. And everywhere it's going all over. And one of our biggest customers now is females. You know, at my age, you never saw a lady in a liquor store or a bar. You go now, how many do you see? Plenty of them. But say, when I started, it was basically a Southern gentleman's drink, and it's become a worldwide drink now.
And what do you think sort of turned it back around? Could y'all pinpoint anything in particular that put it back on the rise?
Well, it was big, say, up into the 70s, and then you young people come along and start drinking that white stuff. I called it that gins and vodkas.
Right.
And now, and then in the late 70s, early 80s, the export market. You younger generation, my age, you know, you done what Dad done. Y'all wanted to do something different, and this is what I'm seeing now. And I say the ladies are big in our business now.
Jimmy, I'm 54. I appreciate being called part of the younger generation.
You are.
But I know part of what you did or part of what y'all did to help with the marketing and stuff is they kind of sent you out on tour, right?
Yes. I was one of the first. Normally, you know, up until, I guess it's 25 or 30 years ago, we was here making it every day, and the only thing we knew about it, if we had a complaint, which we have very few of, that's on time. And then our company decided that somebody from actual making should be out in the field. And I made a complete tour all the way across the United States for about 14 days, going to all talking about. At that day and time, it's all whiskey. It didn't make any difference what it was. Nowadays, it's got so big. You got the bourbon societies. You got the women bourbon societies, women of the world, men's bourbon society. You got everywhere you go now, they've got all these different societies and all. And they know everything that's going on at all times. You make one little change. And first, in 20 minutes, it's on out all over the world. Or in my age, it might be a week before you knew anything could happen.
Now, before, when they started sending you out all over the country and eventually all over the world, had you traveled much before then? Had you been out of Kentucky a whole lot?
Not a whole lot. You know, just around close by states. At my age, I'm 84, so, you know, you stayed at home all the time.
Right. But when you were going out, so you went, I know you went all over the U.S., and then they started sending you to, like, Japan and Australia and places like that, too, right?
Yes. I've been all over the world.
So what are a couple of stories you remember from those times?
Well, the two countries I really like, they're all great, but Japan and Australia. Japan is very formal, everything they do. Australia, here in Kentucky, we use the term loosey-goosey, anything Australia, but I enjoy it. But all the countries, all the European countries, and all of them is wonderful places to go to. But probably Japan and Australia, and they're just opposites from each other. I'll probably enjoy. But Australia is our biggest market now. Japan used to be for export, but Australia's past them now.
How does that feel to you to sort of become a celebrity?
I'm not a celebrity. I'm just plain old Jimmy.
Well, I understand that, but people know who you are.
Oh yeah,
and they respect what you do, and so that, you know, they're I assume in some cases they come to see you, right?
Oh yes, my wife said she don't worry about me when I'm traveling. If I done something wrong, she would know about it before I got back home. But you know, we go out and people's always saying hello to you and everything. And it's when you meet as many people as I have, it's hard to remember their names, but they seem. And then we had about 100,000 visitors go through the distillery last year, and it's going to be more than that this year. Last year, it was over 1,200,000 people went through the Bourbon Trail.
Now, I know when I came to the Wild Turkey Distillery, I'm walking through the gift shop or the little museum there one day, and I saw you just kind of sitting on a bench talking to people and signing autographs and that sort of thing. Do you still do that on a kind of a regular?
I try to get down there at least once today. I got a job here at the distillery, you know, but I try to go down there at least once a day and say hello to people. I enjoy meeting the people and hearing what they have to say. You know, that's where I can get a lot of my information from the visitors that come in here. And we have visitors from all over the world in here all the time. It's a funny story about this. You know, people lives around here hardly ever comes to Stillery unless they got guests. You live around something, it's just natural. You don't pay it. You know all about it, and you don't even go there. But we have visitors from all over the world.
It is funny, Al, and you're never a good tourist in your own town.
Right. You'll travel 100 miles to go see something. It's the same thing might be in your own hometown.
Now, as the master distiller these days, what is your main role? Like, what are you doing every day?
Well, making sure that everything's done right to grains, everything, the fermentation, distillation, the tasting, and everything is done right, making sure it's meeting our standards.
Yeah. And are you paying attention to all this news about the tariffs on bourbon and the possibility of that and that sort of thing? I was wondering if that kind of thing has ever happened before and what it might mean for y'all.
Well, I'm not really sure about it. We're paying a pretty good tariff when we go into foreign countries right now. So that's something that I know, just like a regular 101 wild turkey in Japan is about $75 in American money.
Really?
Yes. So, and now the money change, you know, is a little different too, but places it's high priced, and, you know, products coming in here, I don't think there's any taxes charged on them. You know, our biggest taxes are federal government. They get $13.50 a gallon for every gallon of 100 proof that we bottle.
And that's a lot of gallons every year, I guess. Yeah.
Just remember, we're one brand operation, and our tax bill, just to Uncle Sam, what we ship from the 1st to the 14th of the month has to be paid on the first day of the next month. Ours, we pay about $1.5 million on average every 15 days.
Wow.
$37 to $38 million a year to federal government. And now you take Beam or some of those that's doing vodkas, gins, they're probably paying twice that much.
Sure.
Another thing about Kentucky, the state of Kentucky charges us tax on each barrel that sits here and ages each year.
So no matter how long it sits there, you have to pay a little something every year.
It pays the state something every year.
Wow. Well, I that's a lot of barrels and a lot of whiskey and a lot of bourbon.
Yeah.
So I know that's it's taxed, and there's some money on the other end too. So
actually, you know, we tease about it. We got a barrel and a half of bourbon stored for every person that lives in Kentucky. A little over 4 million people in Kentucky, and right now the bourbon distilleries has got over 7 million bourbon barrels stored.
Well, if I could have a barrel and a half, I might move to Kentucky. Hey, I wanted to ask about, I know a year or two ago, you guys did an ad campaign with Matthew McConaughey.
Yes.
And so how did that come about, and what was that like to work with him and have him around?
Well, he does just commercials for us. He doesn't do anything else. But he's one of the nicest people I've ever been around. He comes right here quite often, and he's just as nice, just plain down to earth as he can be. He comes in here. Only thing about it, you never know what he's going to look like. I've seen him come here with bushy hair and big beards. I've seen him come in. One time I got a little worried about him. He lost 30 pounds to do a Dallas something. He really lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, I remember that movie. Dallas Buyers Club or something like that.
Yes, Dallas Buyers Club. But he's just down to earth as he can be. He's been here quite often. Actually, last year at Thanksgiving, he came here, and he was here about 4 days. Most people didn't even know it. And we, the company, give out 5,000 turkeys. We give a turkey to everybody that lived in Lawrenceburg city limits. A turkey for a day after Thanksgiving for him, and he helped deliver some of them, and we had 250 volunteers that helped deliver it, and they didn't even know he was here until we met. Eddie and I met with him that morning at the Violin House to tell him how he was doing this, and then he come out a little later on. You ought to see the expression on people's face when he come out. They didn't even know he was here.
And so he was giving out the turkeys, huh?
He went to a few houses and gave out. Now, if you listen to everybody in Lawrenceburg, he was their house. I know. He went to my wife's house, and I got in trouble over that. She didn't know he was coming.
So was she not presentable for him? Is that what you're saying?
But all while my family goes to breakfast every Saturday morning, our oldest son had took her to breakfast that morning because Eddie and I had to be here, and they was calling. Eddie was traveling with him and won't know when she got when they got home. So, and then there's 9 ladies here in town. They sold clothes for underprivileged children. He delivered turkeys to their house. And then there was a bachelorette party going on. He went to their house. And we have a fellow here in Lawrenceburg that I know real well. He does a lot of charitable events. He gives a lot of money away, but he don't want anybody to know about it. And he went to his house and delivered a turkey at his house.
Now, wait, I want to back up just a second. He went to a bachelorette party?
He would talk to, yeah, they met him on Main Street here in Lawrenceburg that morning.
Now, you know he's done movies where he's like been like a male dancer for that sort of thing.
No, he just talked to him. And
now, I know a couple of these commercials they've had, that y'all have had, you've been on there.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what it's like for you to flip on the TV and see yourself on the television.
You know, I hardly ever watch them.
Really?
It's, yes. It's one of those things. It's, you know, I just hardly ever watch them. I drive a 98 Ford pickup truck, Ford Ranger.
Uh-huh.
And my wife's been asking me for years, it's a 98, get a new truck. She said we'd never get a new truck now because it's in all the commercials.
So you got to keep it, huh?
Yeah.
How many miles you got on that truck?
94,000.
Oh, it's got plenty to go.
Oh, yeah, it's four-wheel drive. It was one of the first ones they made with four doors, but the two seats in the back are little jump seats like it.
Yeah. Now, Jimmy, I wanted to ask, something I saw maybe in one of those commercials was, and I think maybe your son was talking about this, that you were going to the distillery 6-7 days a week.
Right.
Now, do you still do that?
Oh, yes.
Now, yeah. why do you go so often?
Well, on Saturdays, you know, I told them we'd meet for breakfast every Saturday morning. And my wife likes to come out. I get to spend more time at the visitor center on Saturdays. So we'll go down and spend a couple hours on Saturday morning after breakfast, meeting with people and talking to them. And then on Sundays after church, a lot of time after we eat on Sunday afternoon, we'll come out and spend a couple hours with them. I like to, you know, I want to hear what the people has to say. I enjoy being with the people and seeing what they have to say about it.
Now, you sound like one of those guys who's never going to retire.
First day, it's work. I can actually say this. It's not work to me. It's something I enjoy doing every day. You know, I look forward to, I tell people, I've heard people tell me, I hate to get up and go to work this morning. The first thing I tell them, they need to look for another job. If you're not happy in your work, your family's not going to be happy. Nobody else is happy around you. So I enjoy it. I look forward to getting up and going to work every day.
Jimmy mentioned spending time at the Wild Turkey Visitor Center so he can meet the tourists who come in. I went on a bourbon tour with some friends a couple of years ago, and we happened to be at the Visitor Center one afternoon when Jimmy walked in and sat down on a bench. The whole room sort of leaned his way. People came over with books and T-shirts and whiskey bottles wanting his autograph. But every time somebody came up, he invited him to sit next to him and talk a little bit. He spent most of the time listening. You know, I like a good glass of bourbon, but what I always like better is the people I drink it with. Jimmy Russell understands that just as well as he understands that stuff in the barrels. It's one of his gifts, the skill of leaving a warm aftertaste. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canale. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or recipes for the ideal old-fashioned, email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, wherever else you listen to podcasts. On WFAE.org, each episode has show notes and links with more information on that week's guests. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.